Open your Bible, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 18. We closed with the first few verses of 1 Samuel 18 in the last tape with Jonathan and Jonathan's relation to David and how Jonathan loved David. Here in 1 Samuel 18, we see some great things about David and about his relationship and his faithfulness, his relationship with God and his faithfulness to his task and faithfulness to God. There's some great lessons in 1 Samuel chapter 18, some wonderful lessons in 1 Samuel 18, because it's the same devil that was after David that's after you and I, and the techniques are the same. And remember that we learn about the training and how to live as a Christian. There are lessons in the Old Testament about that, and we see some great lessons here in 1 Samuel 18. Verse 5 of 1 Samuel 18, whatever Saul sent David to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army, and this pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. And as they danced, they sang, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Now, David's killed Goliath, and then the Philistine army was routed. And the women sing, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Saul, the glory grabber, was very angry. This refrain galled him. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but with me only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. David didn't want Saul's kingdom. But Saul here, because of the evil in his heart, projected that on to David. And it's just a fact of life that there will be ungodly and evil people around you as you try to live your Christian life who will project the evil in themselves onto you. The Apostle Paul wrote in the New Testament, yes, and all those who will live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer or undergo persecution. And that's certainly a case here. David didn't do a thing to deserve Saul's evil consideration. Also, I love the accurate use of English here in verse 9. From that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. Jealousy is when you have something and somebody else you think wants it. So they call a jealous husband or a jealous wife because a jealous husband would have this wife that he loved and he's looking out at other men and he doesn't want them getting what he has. So he's jealous. An envious person is someone who doesn't have and wants what another person has. So another man might look at that wife and consider the husband enviously because he wants what the other person has. Well, here Saul has the kingdom. He's concerned David's going to go after it, so he's jealous. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house. Again, this is prophecy by an evil spirit. God and God inspires prophecy in believers. Evil spirits inspire prophecy also, and it's through a study of the Word and an understanding of the things of God and what God is doing that you will be able to discern between the good prophecy and the bad prophecy, evil prophecy and godly prophecy. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. And remember back in chapter 16, David played the harp to try and help Saul through these tough times. Saul had a spear in his hand. And remember about the evil companionships corrupting good behavior? And here's Saul, and there's no enemy around. He's carrying his spear around. The adversary is using that as a contact point for Saul. And he hurled it, saying to himself, I'll pin David to the wall. But David eluded him twice. You know how many times John Shainhite would elude him? Once. You know why? Because I'd leave. I'm not confident I'd leave. But look at David's heart here to help Saul. He knew Saul was trying to kill him, and he stayed. He stayed because he was trying to do his utmost to see if he could get Saul delivered and get Saul helped. And he hung in there and avoided that spear twice. But Saul was afraid of David. And the Hebrew word afraid here indicates a fear or an apprehension. Saul was afraid. He was apprehensive of David because the Lord was with David but had left Saul. Oh, what a great reason to be afraid of somebody because they're godly. But ladies and gentlemen, you're going to run into that in the world, and don't be surprised when it occurred. Look at the people who were afraid of Jesus Christ. And yet, what man wanted to help more? Nobody, nobody, nobody. Jesus Christ, the most loving individual who's ever walked the face of the earth, and people were afraid of him. And it's because they projected that fear that they had in themselves out to Christ. And they will do that to you. And here Saul did it to David. So when it happens in your life, don't be surprised. Don't be caught off guard. But it left Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men. David led the troops and their campaigns. And everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. When Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. And this is a stronger Hebrew word. Extremely afraid. But all Judah and Israel loved David. Well, sure, so should have Saul, because he led them in their campaigns. Saul said to David, "Here's my older daughter, Merib. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." Poor Saul said to himself, "I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that." Verse 18, but David said to Saul, "Who am I? And what's my family or my father's clan in Israel that I should become the king's son-in-law?" So when the time came for Merib, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel of Mahlah. Now, this is interesting. The verse 19, it says, when the time came for Saul's daughter to be given to David, she was given to Adriel of Mahlah. Remember that Proverbs says that hope deferred maketh the heart sick. Something that you really want, all of a sudden you find out that it's gone, it discourages you. And that is another trick of the adversary in people's lives, is to, they expect something, they expect something, they expect something, and then it doesn't happen, and they become discouraged. That's one of the problems with false doctrine. The false doctrine of the word. For example, the idea that you can just go and pray and believe God and receive anything you believe for. Then when you don't believe it and you're discouraged, the tendency to turn into yourself, to turn away from God, to turn away from the things of God. It's deferred hope. It can destroy your relationship with God. And here the adversary is trying to work on David. Hold out this carrot and then yank it away. David, of course, keeps right on with the things of God. Verse 20, now Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David. When they told Saul about it, he was pleased. "I will give her to him," he thought, "so that she may be a snare to him, and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." So Saul said to David, "Now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law." Then Saul ordered his attendants, "Speak to David privately and say, 'Look, the king is pleased with you, and his attendants all like you. Now become the king's son-in-law.'" And they repeated these words to David. David said, "Do you think it's a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and little known." This phrase, "I'm only a poor man," is extremely interesting from the point of view of the integrity of Saul in the text, because if you look back in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 25, the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see this man? How this man keeps coming out?" Talking about, he comes out to defy Israel. They're talking about Goliath. "The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel." In verse 25, the king was supposed to give great wealth to the man who killed Goliath. Of course, Saul was a liar, and he certainly didn't give great wealth to David because he said, "I'm only a poor man." In 24, when Saul's servants told him what David had said, they replied, "Say to David, 'Oh, the king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies.'" Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Again, you see how the adversary works in the lives of believers to set them up and to entrap them. And that's part of the reason for our relationship with God in our prayer life, so we will get through these situations and we won't be beaten up by the devil. Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hand of the Philistines. When the attendants told David these things, he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. So before the allotted time elapsed, David and his men went out and killed 200 Philistines. He brought their foreskins and presented the full number to the king. "Here, king, look, 200. One, two, three, four." And the corner of Saul's going, David was a more than man. Saul said, all I want is 100 Philistines. David said, to become the son-in-law of the king, to marry the king's daughter. Heck, here's 200, and I'll bring you the full count so that he might become the king's son-in-law. And that, again, is indicative of David's wonderful heart toward people and toward God and for service. David wasn't a lazy man. David wasn't a shirker. Saul gave him his daughter Michal in marriage. Verse 28, when Saul realized the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. In chapter 19, verse 1, Saul told Jonathan and all his attendants to kill David. Now finally, Saul here has tried a lot of different things. He's tried to have David killed by the Philistines. He's tried to discourage David in various ways. He's tried to kill David himself by spearing him to the wall in one of his fits. And now in chapter 19, Saul just absolutely becomes public. He says, look, I'm king. What I say is law. Saul told Jonathan and all his attendants to kill David. And now you'll see for the next couple chapters, this goes back and forth because Saul gets convinced to do this, and then David escapes, and then they talk Saul out of this, and David comes back, and then he tries to kill David again, and Saul just goes back and forth and back and forth. And finally, Saul just snaps the other way, and he's absolutely positive he's going to kill David. If you look at chapter 20, this is a time when Jonathan was confronting Saul over this, and in chapter 20, verse 30, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you've sided with the son of Jesse, that's David, don't I know that you've sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. How did he know that? Well, that's exactly what Samuel had said. Samuel said, I'm taking the kingdom away from you, giving it to another. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die. Saul here now is much more interested in continuing his earthly kingdom and his earthly ways than he is in respecting human life and respecting the things of God. Calls Jonathan a son of a perverse woman. Verse 32, look at Jonathan's heart here. Boy, Jonathan stood right up to his father Saul. Why should he be put to death? What's he done? Jonathan asked his father. Verse 33, but Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew his father intended to kill David. Sure, okay, you don't want to be king? I'll kill you. Throw the spear at him. Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. And Jonathan here gets together with David one last time before David runs, and David in chapter 21 takes off. David went to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and said, why are you alone? Why is no one with you? Now David's running from Saul here to save his life. He just gets up and goes, hurry, run, zoom. And he gets to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech is concerned. Why are you alone? Why is no one with you? David didn't have any army with him. And there's a lot of Philistines around and raiding parties and that kind of thing. And of course, that would endanger David's life. And Ahimelech, he's not a military man, but he's smart enough to know that you don't send a commander in the army out to wander around the hills of Judah without some kind of bodyguard force. So Ahimelech is upset by this. He's apprehensive. He's trembling. David, what's going on? How come you're alone? Why is no one with you? David answered Ahimelech the priest, the king charged me with a certain matter and said to me, no one is to know anything about your mission and your instructions. As for my men, I have told them to meet me at a certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find. Verses 2 and 3 are what are called the big lie. There's no truth in that at all. He wasn't on a secret mission to the king at all. He just lied. Verse 4, but the priest answered David, I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there's some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women. Now, the consecrated bread is known as the showbread or the bread of the presence. And you can read about it in Exodus chapter 25, where it talks about the different things that were put in the tabernacle and the bread This bread of the presence was baked once a week and brought into the tabernacle, where it would be inside the tabernacle on a table. 12 loaves, one for each of the 12 tribes, and symbolized the daily bread that God would provide for his people. And it was part of the services of the tabernacle. And it was consecrated, and only the priests were allowed to eat it. Now, the priest here is going to see God's heart in helping one of God's men, and he's going to allow David to eat this consecrated bread. And this is a great record in God's Word in showing how God is so interested in helping people. And Jesus Christ will throw this incident up to the scribes and Pharisees in Matthew chapter 12, verse 3 and following, when the scribes and Pharisees say to Jesus Christ, "And your disciples are working on the Sabbath." And Jesus Christ will refer them to this record about David eating the showbread. In verse 5, well, he says, "We don't have any ordinary bread. We've got this bread of the presence, the consecrated bread, provided the men have kept themselves from women." So David had a few men with him. David replied, "Indeed, women have been kept from us, as usual, whenever I set out. These men's things were holy, even on missions that are not holy. How much more so today?" So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there, except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite. Note that Doeg is not an Israelite, he's an Edomite. Saul's head shepherd. That's great, he's the head shepherd, and he's an Edomite. Again, that shows you more about Saul's nature and his lack of respect for God and the things of God. He's taken a pagan and put him over all of his royal flocks. David asked Ahimelech, "Don't you have a spear or sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's business was urgent." The priest replied, "Well, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine who you killed in the Valley of Elah, it's here. It's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There's no sword here but that one." And remember, the priests were not counted into the army. They wouldn't have a sword. David's story has got to sound fishy. "I left my house in such a hurry, I didn't have time to put on my belt with my sword." I mean, Ahimelech has got to be just scratching his beard and saying, "What in the world is going on?" And David, of course, one lie after another. David said, "There's none like that sword of Goliath. Give it to me." That day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. And if you find Gath in your Oxford Bible Atlas, you'll see David traveling just about due west, a little bit south, down to Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, "Hey, isn't this David, the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sing about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Wow, David's right here." Verse 12, David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So he pretended to be insane in their presence. While he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors of the gate, letting saliva run down his beard. Here's David, and he becomes afraid. Wow, the Philistines know me. They know about me. They're likely to capture me, kill me, parade me around. And certainly, I think the record of Samson and what happened to him as he was captured and some of the other captives they must have known about, he needs to get out of there. Just fakes being a madman. Lets saliva run down his beard, scratches on the door. Achish said to his servants, "Look at the man. He's insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Plus, this man coming to my house? That's what I need, another madman around here. Get this guy out of here, will you?" It was not the most glorious way for David to behave, but it had a good effect. He got out. Chapter 22, David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brothers and his father's household heard about it, they went down to him there, and all those who were in distress, or in debt, or discontented, gathered around him, and he became their leader. Look at David's heart for God's people. He'd been a shepherd. He'd cared for the flock. He was a valiant man. He was a mighty warrior. And when these people came to him and they had needs, they were distressed, they were in discontent, they were in debt, and they came to him and they said, "David, we want you to lead them." You don't see David going to God, "Oh God, what a church you've given me. Look at these people in my congregation. Holy smokes." Or, you know, in the business world, look at these workers I have. Good grief, these were horrible. You don't see David going around and griping and talking about everybody behind their back. He was responsible for these men. A great leader of men. I mean, you remember when Jesus Christ saw the multitudes and the needs that the multitudes had, and Jesus Christ didn't say, "Oh, look at this multitude, man. Needs, needs, needs. Everybody's got needs." I mean, his heart was moved with compassion with them. And that's the way we need to constantly work on our hearts so that we love God's people, support God's people, support each other. And by the way, expect that from others. I don't expect that when I'm in trouble, and you aren't going to live a life without any trouble. It isn't going to happen. Not unless you're born and then die a stillborn or something. You're not going to live a life without some kind of trouble. And it's then that you need support. You don't need anybody coming to you and saying, "Well, I wish you didn't have so-and-so, or you must not have been believing, or you must not have done so-and-so, or you must have had a secret sin in your life." Boy, it's when hard times hit that you need this support and this love. You need somebody to be there for you. And David was there for these men. I love that in David. And he was in a tough situation. The king and his army is hunting him down. And he doesn't say, "Look, all you guys go away. Your lives are in danger." He became their leader. And about 400 men were with him. From there, David went to Mizpah in Moab, said to the king of Moab, "Would you let my father and mother come and stay with you until I learn what God will do for me?" Now remember, David was descended from Moab through Ruth. He had an ancestor from Moab, and he used that as an in. And he's concerned about his mother and his father, and he doesn't want them just out there in the land because he knows that Saul could go capture them and use them as a lever against him. So he says to his mom and dad, "Look, I just need to get you out of the country and out of harm's way here for a little bit." So he takes his mom and dad out of the country over to the king of Moab where they'll find protection. And they stayed with the king of Moab as long as David was in the stronghold. And then the prophet Gad shows up and says to David, "Don't stay in the hold. Go to the land of Judah." Verse 6. Now Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered. And Saul, spear in hand, was seated under the tamarisk tree at Gibeah with all his officials standing around him. And Saul said to them, "Listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds?" Boy, look at him appeal to greed in people. He didn't appeal to anything noble. He says, "The son of Jesse, he's a Judean. Will he give you Benjamites? Will he give you Benjamites' fields? Will he give you Benjamites' command in his army?" Verse 8, "Is that why all of you have conspired against me?" Which, of course, was a lie because they hadn't. "No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is concerned about me or tells me my son's incited my servant." And here's the king of Israel and he's crying in his beer. "None of you is concerned about me." Lies and self-pity. And then he's incited my servant to lie and wait for me as he does this day, which of course was not true. Verse 9, "But Doeg the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's officials, said, 'Well, I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, son of Ahitub at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him, also gave him food and the sword of Goliath the Philistine.' The king sent for the priest Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, and his father's whole family, who were priests at Nob, and they all came to the king. Saul said, 'Listen now, son of Ahitub.' 'Yes, my lord,' he answered. Saul said to him, 'Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, giving him food and a sword and inquiring of God for him, so that he's rebelled against me and lies in wait for me, as he does today?' Ahimelech answered the king, 'Who of all your servants is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard, highly respected in your household? Was that the first time I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant of any of his father's family, for your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair.'" Well, David lied to Ahimelech, Saul lies to Ahimelech and the people, and Ahimelech's the only one in the whole blasted affair that's telling the truth. He didn't know anything about what was going on. But the king said, "You will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your father's whole family." The king ordered the guards at his side, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew when he was fleeing, yet they didn't tell me." But the king's officials were not willing to raise a hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Thank God. You know, if there's going to be a godly society that we're going to live in, somebody's got to stand up for the things of God. Saul here, unbelievable that he would kill the priests. Verse 18, "And the king ordered Doeg," and remember, Doeg is an Edomite. He's a foreigner. He's a stranger. He doesn't care about the things of God. You turn and strike down the priests. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. He also put to the sword Nob, the town of the priests, with its men, its women, its children and infants, its cattle, donkeys, sheep. What a heinous crime. Verse 20, but Abiathar, son of Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, escaped and fled to join David. He told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, That day, when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would surely tell Saul, I am responsible for the death of your father's whole family. Oh, the weight of that must have fallen so hard on David's shoulders. He'd lied to the priest, and now the priest was dead. And how do you get more priests? They're born. You didn't go up and sign up on a sheet of paper or go to seminary to be a priest. You had to be born of the lineage of Aaron. And now an entire priest town is gone, is destroyed, because David had lied. In his heart, he knew when Doeg was there, he should have done something about it that day. I knew it! And the full force of what he had done, or actually in this case not done, by not taking care of the situation, fell on him. You know, I've got a question for you. Why is it the Bible calls David a man after God's own heart? Why is it? You know, if you paraded out the different men of the Old Testament, and you show a guy like Samuel, or Elijah, or Elisha, and you look at their lives, or Job, or Nehemiah, great men, they don't sin, they don't cause God problems, they're tremendous men, and you look at David, he lies, and an entire priest city is destroyed. He commits adultery with a believer's wife. He has a believer murdered in cold blood. Against the word of God, he numbers the people. He counts the people at 2 Samuel 24, which God said specifically not to do the way David did it. 70,000 people died as a plague. He mishandled his family life. His third son killed his oldest son, murdered him. Then his third son rises in rebellion against David, and when his third son is killed, what's David do? He goes up in front of all the people and wails and embarrasses his army. His fourth son rebels against him. You know, David had sin after sin after sin in his life. If sin keeps a person from being a man after God's own heart, David should have never made the roster. And yet here is David, who God shows his dirty underwear on every page, and then God turns around and says, this man is a man after God's own heart. Ladies and gentlemen, it can't be a sinless life. What's it going to be? David kept coming back to God, coming back to God, coming back to God, coming back to God. God knows your faults and your failures. They do not keep you from being after God's own heart. What keeps you from being after God's own heart is when you allow those to continue to separate you from God and you won't come back to do the will of God. And David, time and time again, came back. Let us be like David. That's the end of this side of the tape.